The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
When we look at the erasure of consequences and the muting of signals, you just have to broaden your spectrum and look at other things that give you signs and indicators. And money printing, monetization, do they matter? Yes. The U.S. dollar has dropped from 102 in March to 92 and change here in early September. If it doesn't bounce soon, we are going to have some real issues. And the dollar is telling more of the story at this point.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, David, we've come out of 4 weeks with various guests, and there really was a deliberate action in all of that. As we look at what could be either devastating consequences of a lot of debt or the erasure of consequences and a continuation just by taking out more debt, we've had guests that have talked about both. I think it's interesting so that we can learn how to argue our own point, to listen to people who maybe don't agree with everything we're thinking.
You know, I think it's fun to have options. And if you can ever hit the restart button, like when you're playing a video game, it's just not going well for you. You realize you're not going to get a new high score.
Right.
I think back to when I had one of my kids and it was like the first week. And so I'm not involved really. I mean, I can help do dishes or whatever else, but there's a lot of things that I can't do.
Right.
And so I'm up late at night playing Angry Birds on my iPad. And, you know, I know right. from the first shot whether or not it's going to be a good game or not. And I'm going to do over. And then I want another do over. Now I want another do over. And it was amazing. I got all time high scores and I just kept on getting all time high scores. And if I looked at the games that I threw away, the opportunity to restart was pretty compelling.
Well, the difference between a video game, okay, where you don't feel the restart at all. Okay. Let's say you're playing one of those shooters, first person shooters. You don't really feel it. So you can press the button. I remember when I went paintballing with my son, the difference between hitting the restart button and actually getting hit with paint, you realize you're not going to get away without some sort of consequence. And I think, you know, paintball then to the next level would be a real gunfight.
Well,
in a real gunfight, you really don't have the chance to hit reset, do you?
I'll never forget my brother and his best friend Shane used to hit the paintball on the weekends. And I don't know what it was, if it was machismo or they just knew they weren't going to get hit because they were that good.
They took their shirts off.
That's
I was
exactly
with them.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I remember when Shane was bleeding. He was showing it off. Yeah. But okay. So going to that, in a way, the Federal Reserve has allowed us to pretend that we can hit the reset button without consequence. You know, Richard Duncan talked a little bit about that, and he's like, well, just keep hitting the reset button, baby. Borrow more.
Yeah, so we just finished the best August for stocks since 1986, and it was the worst August for the U.S. dollar since 2005. And I think that's a fascinating contrast. I think there's a story to be told there. You know, over the last few weeks on the commentary, we've journeyed through the ideas of the fourth turning. And it just so happens that we are at a critical time of social and cultural angst. And I think that discussion with Neil Howe brings perspective to the current events, which have taken a decidedly violent tone of late. And it removes, actually, some partisan conclusions by stretching back into sociological trends that transcend a single election cycle.
Well, and it's so easy to do that. We have to really teach ourselves when we get 80 or 90 days away from an election to not think only for 80 or 90 days. I mean, we really do need to think beyond election cycles and actually beyond presidential terms.
Well, I care about politics and I care who wins and I have my own personal views on what the impacts will be. But more critically, from a professional standpoint, to be able to better grapple with those issues and the concerns, I think, again, that conversation helps us appreciate the longer term tides and currents influencing the current spirit of the age.
Okay, but the spirit of the age is influenced by this reset button that we call the credit markets. How much can you borrow without having to pay it back? And that was the question for Doug Noland. That was the question for Richard Duncan. It was the question for Lila Murphy. How do you navigate when you don't know whether the reset button's going to work or not? It's been interesting. And then Neil Howe, of course, talks about how do you navigate the next 100 years?
Well, that's right. And you might think that the outcome in November is, the outcomes are visible. You think a Trump victory is good for equities. Perhaps it's better than a Biden victory from that standpoint. But political uncertainty can still exist and can still roil the markets. If, you know, we go back to this idea of the fourth turning, and if violence levels increase, And so I think here again, the fourth turning is as prescient as ever. But you're right, it's not by accident that we're also in recent weeks considering the credit markets, those dynamics and the financial market excesses as a complement to these late cycle social trends. Mm-hmm. You have loose credit conditions, which create an allowance. They encourage reckless investment and capital allocation. And of course, there's immediate upside benefits. And Wall Street, I think, probably amused by and maybe even addicted by those immediate upside benefits, no longer looks to the longer term consequences and no longer looks at the impact of being over leveraged.
Well, and aren't we already experiencing consequences? I mean, you look at the social unrest and you look at the wealth disparity. We may think because the stock market's hitting all time highs that we're not experiencing consequences, but actually they're showing up, aren't they?
This has been an enduring issue prior to the 2016 election. I mean, these conditions of easy money and easy credit exaggerate wealth disparity, and they feed resentments and judgments across economic classes. Too often, the present is prioritized at the expense of the future. And it's going to be the generations to come that will remember this era as either incredibly short-sighted or incredibly selfish, maybe a combination. Hmm. But what we've done with allowing the Federal Reserve to sort of manage the system, we've created the machinery that sucks tomorrow's economic life and vitality out of the future into the present. And that has a host of cultural consequences, which we started to see prior to 2016. And of course, they're readily on display today as well. Redistribution, radical politics. These are the flip side of monetary policies that primarily benefit limited segments within society. So to some, this will seem a non sequitur. And for others, these are the appropriate dots to connect. But central bank monetary policies are a principal cause in this unfolding social strain.
And that's why it's so important to look at views that you don't necessarily agree with, because we've all been taught that all debt gets paid. We raise our kids and we say, look, don't go into too much debt. Make sure that you pay your bills. But what we're seeing is a system that's completely built on debt. You know, both Doug Noland and Richard Duncan agreed on a point, and that is that debt has become the new money. Now, you know, as you consider those credit markets that you're talking about, okay, which are causing consequences in the social side of things, but they actually still are fueling what looks like a financial boom or a bubble in the markets. We have to look at both and say, okay, do these have a limit? Is there a consequence to come? And so the Duncan Noland interviews, those are worth actually going back and listening to, because whether you're Democrat or Republican, strangely enough, either party right now is using debt to fuel the next wave.
Oh, yeah. There is a commonality between the Republicans and the Democrats. Both of them are dependent on the credit markets to enable the next step. And fiscal policy is obviously loose on both sides. It's not a question of quantities. It's just a question of flows and who gets the quantity of flows. We've considered the credit markets from a similar vantage point. You know, again, credit excess, as you mentioned, these two different analytical frameworks, Noland and Duncan, two very different conclusions in terms of the diagnosis and prescription, which has meant that for our listeners, you get to engage with a range of possible policy outcomes and, of course, a range of effects in the financial markets. You know, are we setting up for an equity market decline like 1973-74, 2000, 2002, 2007, 2008.
Yeah, but those had consequences. I mean, there was a decline of massive. I mean, didn't they lose about half of their value?
Yeah, and I think a part of the rigor in the commentary for our listeners, it reminds me of something that happened routinely in my wife's house when she was growing up, which is her stepdad would debate with her on a topic. And halfway through the conversation, he would say, switch. And instantly, they both have to take the other side of the argument and argue effectively and finish the argument.
That's a great technique.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
So the Noland Duncan, it's just important that you engage in such a way that you've considered the 10th man's perspective, that you've considered the devil's advocate's perspective and see a whole range of outcomes. So it's very possible, very probable that we have a 50% decline in equities, like those past market declines. And, you know, today that would bring the Dow just over 14,000. That would return the NASDAQ to its previous decades-long peak of between 5,500 and 6,000.
Yeah, but Duncan said, no, let's just spend another $10 trillion and find some technology that'll pull us out of this.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a possibility. And if you don't argue for it effectively, you probably don't understand the argument for it. Or, you know, do we move here to the infinity zone? Duncan suggested the $10 trillion policy initiative may very well act as an accelerant to an already overpriced market. You know, you get Tesla trading at over 1,000 times earnings. You know, could that be seen as either the beginning of manic behavior more broadly, or is it the beginning of the end? And I mean, I favor the latter interpretation.
Well, and that's why then we had Lila on, because Lila actually has to. You've said this for years, Dave. Talking to people about theory is great. And, you know, there's academics out there that write papers. They spend their entire life, and they're helpful because they study deeper what we can't study because we don't have time. Here's the problem. They're not the man on the street. They're not having to make active decisions where they're actually, it's like that paintball game. You know, it's not a video game. You get out, and if you're exposed, you get hit. Okay. And Lila has to make decisions. You do. Robert, Doug, you guys have to get in there and go, okay, well, do we buy something today? Do we sell, or do we stay in cash?
You know, I studied philosophy in college, and I still like reading philosophy on occasion. And certainly some of my friends are in that profession, so to say, the you know, professional thinkers and writers in the ivory tower. And I certainly love to read academic stuff. But the reason I departed from that and found myself in the world of finance is because so many of these ideas boiled down to action. Aristotle said something very simple. Human flourishing is found in action. Mm. And you can contemplate your navel, which may have its own value, or you can do something like clean the lint out of your navel. I mean,
Dave, you've always taught
me that example, but
you've taught me ideas matter.
Right.
See, that's what you're really saying. There's ideas, and then there's ideas matter. And you pay the price, obviously, every day.
That's right. When you're actively in the market, you have your judgment called into question and measured, marked to market every day.
Mm-hmm.
So we last week entered the conversation with Lila. Plan of action emerges out of the theoretical conversations and the speculations of what the future holds. We must act.
Mm-hmm.
Doing nothing actually is still a choice. That's just stasis. And sometimes that's appropriate. What do you base your actions on? What are the most predictable, the most probable inputs into the investment equation?
Well, you have to answer the question of what the central bankers are going to do, Dave, because they have had probably the greatest effect of anything over the last 10 years on the markets.
Yeah. One of the pillars of our thesis is that central banks will, in essence, take off the gloves and transition to the equivalent of a bare knuckle fight to maintain the status quo.
Right.
So, you know, all bets are off, and it's not clean. It's not by the rules. But what are they trying to accomplish? They are trying to, in essence, end the business cycle. They want the continuation of perpetual growth. They want to guarantee price stability, as if that is within the power of central bankers. And frankly, when you think about price stability, that may turn out to be some version of cold death, unintended, of course.
Mm. You know, you asked the question, can they continue to control this? And last night, Dave, when we were sitting, you were having your cigar, I was having my Talisker, we were getting to be a little bit philosophical like we do, but we were looking back at this show. And you love talking to people who are in that central banking community, people we may not necessarily agree with the actions on. I'm thinking of Otmar Issing, who was the head of the European Central Bank and sort of the father of the euro. He was head of the European Central Bank for 7 years. Then we've had several others, you know, Carmen Reinhart. We've had William White. We've had Paul Tucker. And
so that covers the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, the Bank of International Settlements.
And now the World
the
Bank.
The ECB. World Bank with
right.
Carmen.
Right. And they all got to a point with you, Dave, during the interview, admitting that they don't necessarily think this is as much a science as it is an art, and they're all still wondering if it's going to work themselves.
Yeah, but I wonder if out of hyper control or a drive towards policy control comes hyper chaos. Mm. And, you know, regardless of what we think in terms of constructing portfolios that are suitable in the worst of times, we need them to be just that, suitable in the worst of times, constructive in the best of times.
And okay, so, but does that bring real things into the equation?
Well, that's
because when paper collapses, you still have real things sitting there, like oil and gold and lumber, and you know, they're still real.
That's why I like to say, if I can step my toe on it, walk around it, wrap my arms right. around it, owning real things, hard assets, whether it's across the globe. You know, we include multiple iterations which provide healthy income. What we believe to be sustainable income streams. That's what we do. Now, I wanted to say something about my cigar last night.
Oh.
Just, I might as well tell you here and now.
Yeah.
I'm done until after the race in November.
Really?
Yes.
For the listener who doesn't understand this, this is huge.
Yeah, I know.
Did you put the cigars away till?
No, but I should probably lock the humidor and give the key to somebody who will summarily lose it.
So tell me why, because I'm not finished with Talisker any stretch of the imagination.
I know. I'm to the most intense part of the training cycle, and it's important that from blood pressure standpoint I want everything going for me.
And you're doing a full Ironman. For those who don't remember, you're doing a full Ironman in November down in Florida.
Right. So rest and recovery is pretty critical. And
140 miles.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So I actually needed to just say it publicly so that there's a level of accountability here, because I actually burdened my wife with that last night. I'm like, all right, you got to help me.
You locked the humidor for the next few, actually till after the election. Let's call it a lock of the humidor until after the election. But
I said the one exception for alcohol consumption was red wine with steak. If it was socially engaging, like we have guests over or it's date night. So, and then a sip of someone else's is just fine. So I don't want to be a complete social prude, but I do want to finish this. And more than that, I want to survive this.
All right. Let me try as a active member of this commentary to try to segue back to what we were talking about.
Sorry.
No, let me try because there are times when you have to say, okay, this is not the way we've been thinking up to this point, but we now need to think about the next step. And that's what you did. See, last night when we were talking, you never mentioned that you were going to give up cigars right after we hung up with each other. But let's look at what you and your dad did back in 2005, because I've worked for him now for 33 years, and you guys, okay? And we basically talked about other investments being, we didn't poo-poo other investments, but we basically said, look, gold is your option if paper assets are no longer viable. But we always had in the back of our mind, what do we do when gold's reached its peak relative to, say, the Dow or what have you? And you guys sat down in 2005. You had come from the stock brokerage industry. Your dad started there, okay, back in the 60s. And you guys sat down and you said, okay, let's create something that's still real, like gold, but will benefit during a period of time when maybe gold is no longer the only necessary option for hedging.
Yeah, the gloves-off approach from the central banks, I don't think ends very quickly. Their admission of failure doesn't come quickly. There's a lot of ego involved in the project that is in play.
Can they even extract themselves? That's the question.
Yeah, I think the current trend that we have is one that will last. But you're right, the idea of rehearsing what is next is really key. And so the context for what we do in the asset management space goes back to 2005. That's when my father and I discussed that need to clearly define what was next. That is, as the metals bull market matured, we were imagining this future point and having a conversation about what we would do as a family. Mm-hmm. Where would we diversify our metals holdings? And when the timing was appropriate, where would we reallocate some funds? Not everything, but some funds, reducing total precious metals holdings after having benefited from their price appreciation. So we launched the asset management company in 2008, 13 years ago, not a moment too soon, in my opinion, because it took the better part of 10 years to refine the team and the process we employ. And that process is one that Lila contributes to, that Doug contributes to. You mentioned Robert, myself. We engage with that on a continual basis. And since that refinement of personnel and process, the positive outcomes have become more reliably duplicatable. As we look at the years and decades ahead, I look and say, yep, right people, right place, right team,
As you train, talking about the team, you know, you're training for a type of event physically that most people would never dream of doing. Okay, 140 miles is a long distance. But when you brought this team together and you started to listen to their past experiences, discipline, you know, the reason you put your cigars away, honestly, all jokes aside, is because you've done other races. You now know that this is the correct discipline. You'd rather have the cigar. You'd rather have maybe a Talisker. But the discipline puts it away. And, you know, Lila's disciplined. Doug is disciplined. And those disciplines, there's give and take. Sometimes there's friction, which is wonderful because in an algorithmic program, there is no friction. But with people,
there's friction. There is.
But there's discipline. There's discipline. Even if in their gut, they're like, you know, I think we need to go buy this. It's like, well, tell me about your gut plus the discipline.
Yeah. So I had a little friction after our cigar and whatever last night, which, and that's why I hadn't made that decision then, but I went on a run between 11 and midnight. And so it was at that point that I thought, you know, I think between rest and recovery and, you know, effectively plugging in the exercise where I can, and sometimes it is an odd hour. So, yeah, you know, discipline marks my personal life in those ways. It's very idiosyncratic. Maybe the kinds of things that I like to read and when I read, training, time spent with my family, all these things are priorities, and they're all reflecting routines, which I hope drive positive results, whether it's intellectual maturity or emotional family connection or, you know, accomplishing that particular goal with the Ironman. And disciplines are needed. And, you know, when I look at the asset management business, the team today thrives on them. Mm-hmm. And that's the core of our conversations. It's what drives the backbone of our checklists and our scoring and what we do on a routine basis.
Well, and sometimes sparks fly. I mean, the old iron sharpens iron applies here too.
Well, and maybe that is the beauty of having studied philosophy, because conversation, debate, analysis, all of that is right up my alley. And so to bring an orderly process to that for decision making and action, it's fantastic. And I have to say, I really appreciate the contribution that both Doug and Lila make to that orderly process. Because again, we're talking about decades of having worked in that field and also quite a bit of time working together. Mm-hmm. So the banter is cohesive. It has a maturity which goes beyond sort of the 18 months that Lila's been with us, because they've been working together for better part of a decade.
Well,
or more.
Like I said, it's not a machine. It's not an algorithm. People are necessary and they're involved in this.
And so it's not always easy because people are involved. But people are involved, which in my book holds greater value than turning everything over to a machine.
You know, when we're talking to clients and they're looking at the stock market and they're seeing the massive growth it looks like in the stock market, it's like COVID is over. We no longer have a recession. But really, the stock market itself isn't doing that well. It's like eight stocks that are pulling everything else up. So would you give a little bit of definition of the difference between the stock market overall right now and what they call the awesome eight?
Yeah, the bank credit analyst expanded FANGs. I guess we're running out of things to add to that as an acronym. So now they're just calling them the awesome eight: Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Netflix, Nvidia, selling video cards, very helpful if you're mining Bitcoin or things like that. And then last but certainly not least, Tesla. Those names have dominated the move since the March lows. So when we started selling off, I think the highs were right in around February 19th and the lows about the third week of March, the S&P 500 on an equal weighted basis has barely moved for the year. Now, keep in mind, the S&P 500 is a cap-weighted index. So the largest names continue to get the largest flows of capital from the index investor. If you're looking at things on an equal-weighted basis, actually, you see this huge divergence between those eight names, which are motoring higher, and everything else, which is more or less moribund, stuck in the mud. And so any broader measure of stocks, the Russell 2000, the Value Line Geometric Index, they're negative for the year. Mm. And this is what we've described as negative breadth, which is different than bad breath, but still not necessarily pleasant.
Negative breath. Yeah, I'll start calling it that, actually.
Okay. It means, you'd throw the D in there. It means that there are a few names moving higher, but that the broader collection of names is not moving up or is not moving up to the same degree. And I think a negative breadth number is a fascinating indicator. I see the same curious behaviors with gold stocks. If you look at the big names, they end up catching the capital flows as money comes into the asset category through an index. There's a disproportionate inflow and outflow with the big names present in those indexes. And if a particular name isn't on an index, it trades very differently. Frankly, I kind of like it because it trades on its own merits.
So it seems the equities, you know, the stock market in general, and especially these eight stocks that are doing extremely well, it has something to do, obviously, with the printing of money. Now, Jackson Hole is something that it's sort of a punctuation point in the year for the central bankers. In August, they meet in Jackson Hole. Of course, we've had some guests on that are usually at Jackson Hole, like Carmen Reinhart. And this year, they're basically talking about allowing higher inflation as if it's a gift, the gift that we're going to go ahead and give you is no longer 2% inflation, but we think now 2.5 makes sense.
Yeah. And just one more thing on that view of the awesome eight. It starts with the market. If the market index looks good, then the assumption is that the economy must be improving. And there are some measures of economic improvement. I'm not saying there's not, but this is where I'm going. The flow of thought for the average market participant is look at the index. Index is up. Okay. Check that box. Economy must be good. Okay. Check that box. The third box to check is I feel okay. So market okay, economy okay, mood okay. Market not okay, economy not okay, mood not okay.
So Jackson Hole actually affects the mood of the country as well, whether they know it or not.
Yeah. And to your point on you know, this being a critical sort of once a year soiree, it's a great place to ski. This is where the Fed does their annual meeting. This year was a little bit wonky because of Zoom and whatever. So what did they shift of real significance? The inflation policy, I think, was noteworthy for two reasons. One was the belief that you can turn the dial from a 2% inflation target to something that is going to average more than 2%. So they've said 2.5%. And again, the problem here is it's not as if you're dealing with sensitively tuned apparatus where you just turn the dial and get what you want. It ignores the fact that for the better part of 5 years, the Fed has tried to fine-tune a 2% number, and it's been an exercise in futility. I think now that inflation is on the rise, they're claiming that a higher number is acceptable, which seems to me like a credibility cover.
Oh, yeah, we're purposely doing this.
Yeah,
purposely
exactly.
Doing this.
And implying that they like 2.5%,
yeah.
but not more than 3% annual inflation. Again, as if they are turning a simple dial to get exactly what they want. This is not a precision instrument. This is not something they actually have control over. So the second part is we've harped on the dual extractive nature of financial repression and inflation. And those trends continue with a higher degree of extraction. Inflation will go up, but look, rates are not going to go up at a commensurate pace. Rates will remain low. Some central bankers are actually going back to reaffirm the usefulness of negative rates as a tool in their policy toolbox. The Bank of England last week was only too happy to affirm the use of negative rate structures as a part of their overall strategy when and where necessary.
Yeah, but Jerome Powell, okay, so there's a little bit of hypocrisy here because Powell's like, I don't think we really need negative interest rates at this point. But Dave, if you have 2.5 or 3 or 4% inflation and you have rates that are below that, are we not already negative?
Right. And again, I think Powell has said we don't need negative rates at this point because he's comfortable with the tools that are in practice today, forward guidance, which is basically setting market expectations, guiding the mind of the market, so to say, and then asset purchases, which is setting prices. So setting expectations and setting prices, they feel like they've got enough power. But I tell you, if the swelling of the balance sheet past $10 trillion is not sufficient, they will revisit the negative rates.
They'll do whatever they have to. So inflation, what in the world are they doing calling it 2%? Because if you were to look at Dr. Copper, okay, which we've talked about through the years, Dr. Copper's up, 29%? Lumber, how much is lumber up?
127% year to date. Now, part of this is artificial in the fact that it's driven by your housing stats and home building. Because if you think about the migration from cities, you're seeing a response to COVID. You're seeing a response to unrest, and people are moving to suburbs or beyond the suburbs. And so there is some positive home building, and the multiplier off of home building is a pretty powerful thing. So lumber year to date is up 127%. Copper is up 29%. But where you begin to say, actually, maybe it's a combination of that migration and a larger inflationary thematic is you look at silver, you look at most of your industrial metals, really not tied to a move in housing. And most of them are up double digits. So it suggests that hard assets are coming back into the mainstream, though slowly. And I think there is still a lot of reallocation still to occur into commodities and gold.
Why don't you address that right now? Because sometimes we'll hear, well, gold's near $2,000 an ounce, so it must be fully invested. I mean, it must be overbought. But if you actually look at the average portfolio, it hardly has anything in it.
Right. I mean, UBS published research on the strategic asset allocation of global family offices. So these are your ultra high net worth families, let's say 50 million to 5 billion. And on average, their cash was sitting around 7.6%. Gold and precious metals was 0.8%. And commodities, which is a combination of agriculture, lumber, et cetera, combined, that would be your oil exposures too, energy, 2.4%. So a minuscule exposure to real things other than real estate with a much higher 17% allocation. So I think when I look at the commodity space, when I look at the gold space, and when I look at some of your larger pockets of capital around the world, you're not talking about a crowding effect, not by a long shot. There are concerns that the metals in a bubble. And to me, if you want to know what a bubble looks like, see a 2-year chart of Tesla, see a 2-month chart of Tesla, see a 2-week chart of Tesla. I mean, you know, when you get a 76% move in 14 trading sessions, and then somebody thinks, well, gold's in a bubble because it's gotten above 2000. Listen, the inflation adjusted price is somewhere between 2600 and 2800. Historically, you've got to go twice the inflation adjusted price before you begin to run out of buyers. And so you're talking about a $5,000 gold price, double the inflation adjusted price, which is clearly not an economically sustainable number. It won't stay at those levels, but you run out of buyers at about twice the inflation adjusted price, whether that's natural gas, oil, or pick your commodity. They can move higher. They can move to unsustainable levels, but this is not it.
Do you think there's a general ignorance right now with the type of person who's actively participating in the market? We're in a different generation where people don't just typically own gold in a portfolio. I mean, in the old days, well, starting with central banks worldwide keep about a third of their liquid assets in gold. But portfolios, you know, going back 50 or 100 years, what would they have? Maybe 10 or 20% in gold just as an allocation. These days, nobody even thinks that way.
As recently as the 1970s, you know, just to go back to those cycles, gold was a standard 10% allocation for wealthy families. And that was common in the 70s, but also note, it was common in a period of time, common here in the United States and globally, as metals were putting in the cycle highs. So it gains popularity. People start to put it into their portfolios. Unfortunately, they're typically coming late to the cycle and are not anticipatory. Frankly, in many parts of Europe, that 10% allocation has never changed. It's still acceptable. But I think you have the new rich, the nouveau rich, which have yet to understand the allocation role of gold and silver. And frankly, few of them know why a healthy insurance policy is even necessary. They haven't known hardship, not like past generations have. So, you know, there will be some very valuable lessons learned and education gained, tuition paid for in the context of a solid, protracted equity bear market where most of your world's wealth is still sitting in equities and bonds. So, you know, again, 10% in gold, from that to 0.8% in gold, I'd say it's underowned. Energy, from 20% of the S&P 500 to less than 4% now, underowned. With patience and discipline, you can capture the revaluation of asset classes and build significant wealth off of low cost basis.
Okay. So let's look at patience. Let's look at patience just for a minute, because what you're talking about from an analogy point of view of putting the cigars away until the race, there's a level of patience there. It doesn't necessarily make sense to your flesh right now. Your flesh would like to continue to to have a drink every once in a while or a cigar. Really, patience in the investment field is buying something that nobody else is buying. And so you have to almost get rid of your self-insecurity, needing someone else's approval. You really don't have approval if you have patience in the investment world. You're almost always looked at as the wrong guy on the wrong day at the wrong time.
Right. And it's so funny to me that as I talk to folks and they're like, well, tell me about your performance this year, that year, this. And it's always compared to, well, what if I mean, I could have owned Amazon and done that much better. I could have owned Facebook and done that much better. I could have done much better owning Microsoft or
Tesla.
Rear view
mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest one of all, right?
Right.
The rear view mirror is easy for all of us.
Yeah. And I think the great successes in investing are anticipatory. And it's when time and the tide of events has played out that you get to look back and say, I positioned accordingly because this is what I saw coming and I bore the fruit from that. And, you know, Aristotle, yet another quote, I suppose, Mark Faber mentioned this in a recent missive, patience is bitter, but the fruit is sweet. And I was stuck, again, idiosyncratic reading. I was stuck in the early chapters of Leviticus, an Old Testament book of the Bible, which I frankly don't recommend. I was reading that earlier this week, but according to Jewish law, the fruit of a tree is not to be harvested for at least 3 years.
Right.
And, you know, then they've got their seventh year, let the fields lay fallow and recover. There's these ideas of rest. And of course, the 50 years, the Jubilee.
It goes against the perpetual growth religion is what it does.
It goes against the
perpetual growth religion.
It does. And I think one of the reasons I was reading Leviticus was because I went back to Tomas Sedlicek's book, The Economics of Good and Evil. Mm. And he looks at the ways that wealth have been viewed through various worldviews. One of them being, if you're going back to early time, is the, you know, this Fertile Crescent and that part of the world. So yeah, you can't harvest for 3 years. And I thought that was fascinating. Alan Newman recorded this week in his most recent missive. It's always the last one because he's basically retired. But he has to write.
And he always says, I'm not going to do it again.
But I love a guy who has to say something,
yeah.
Right? Alan Newman recorded that the average holding time for equities, whether you're talking about individual shares, mutual funds, ETFs, it's come down over time. If you're looking at sort of 1926 to 1998, the average was 3 years, 9 months as a holding period. So again, you really weren't harvesting for over 3 years either.
Hmm.
1926 to present, so now you're tacking on the last 20-odd years. The averages have changed. It's no longer 3 years, 9 months. It's 3 months, 25 days. And again, bear in mind that brings in all of the old data and the new. Today's holding periods to bring that average down so considerably, you know, the time till we pluck the fruit, so to say, it's now days, it's now microseconds and nanoseconds. And it's, I think, a different way of thinking about, it's a different way of engaging the capital markets.
Yeah, going back to the 1980s, Dave, when we started looking at actually working in managed funds, one of the things we would do, like with mutual funds, is we'd look at their cash position. You know, so let's say they had $100 in there total, but they had 98 of it invested. Well, that didn't leave but $2 for liquidations without them having to go and liquidate more. Alan Newman, one of the things I love about his writing is he's always looking at the cash levels to see where they're at, because it gives a good indication of two things. One is overall bullishness. How much do we want to be invested? But the second thing is, how vulnerable are they? How low is the cash in case there's liquidations?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting dynamic in terms of forced liquidations if you don't have enough cash to meet redemptions and sales. I have a friend in Kansas City who manages a mutual fund for a fund company out there, about a $2 billion mutual fund. He's been with them 20 plus years.
Hmm.
And a new CEO came into the business recently, and he pulled all the fund managers in and he said, you will not maintain cash balances. That is not your mandate. You have your mandate. If someone wants cash, they can raise it and sit on it themselves. And what he's really saying is, guys, we're facing an existential threat. We cannot have our returns equal that of the indexes if we're not fully invested. And people will look at a relative performance and say, if you're not performing as well as the S&P, why don't I just invest in an index fund? So the whole mutual fund industry is also dealing with a structural constraint where they have to put everything in. They want to put everything in, lest they go the way of the dodo bird.
And that creates a self-fulfilling prophecy when the stock market starts going down, because they have to sell to raise cash.
That's right. It magnifies. It magnifies. It's a, what do they call it? A force multiplier by not having enough in reserves. So yeah, Newman loves to talk about cash levels. It is an indicator of how fully invested the speculative community is. No surprise that last month levels hit an all-time record low at 2.2%. So part of that is pushing money into the market on a speculative basis. A part of it is the pressure of the mandate, be fully invested. And that's a new structural change for mutual funds to have to deal with, and on the competitive nature of things. So the thing to remember is that sentiment is exaggerated, and sentiment swings to extremes at the end of a move. So cash balances are just an indicator. I mean, he loves talking about how much money is borrowed on margin. And, it's only $600 billion or so of borrowed money from the house used to buy stocks that you didn't have the money for. And yeah, the clock is ticking. Yes, you're paying interest on that. And yes, it ultimately has to be paid back, hopefully at a profit, not a loss. There's also, from Newman, he views the March lows and the recovery since then. I thought this was fascinating. He views it as the biggest bear trap in history.
Which, let's just put a little context on Newman for a moment, because he watched his dad not look at his stocks from the 1929 crash until, what was it, the 1960s that Newman got in there and looked at it, that his dad became so incredibly depressed after the losses in the stock market, he wouldn't even open the safe and look at the stocks.
Yeah, I'm going to quote him from something he said in his most recent note. Despite the speed and the depth of the one-month collapse in March, there was no capitulation. Now, he's a guy to talk about capitulation,
yes,
because he understands the psychology of capitulation. His dad was a broker in the 1920s, quit, and all of his stock certificates he put in a bank box and didn't open until the 1960s. Actually, he asked his son to research what was in there.
Yeah.
Don't care what they are.
Yeah.
Don't care what they're worth. Tell me if there's anything left. I mean,
this is deep in the family DNA. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Bear traps.
What does capitulation look like? What is a bear trap? What we did get was an intervention response from the Fed. So this is also kind of classic bear market action. A big push to the downside, policy response, which gave us the bounce that we have now. And now we wait to see how the bear unfolds. I just don't buy that we're in a new bull market.
Well, we have the erasure of consequences. We started the program talking about pushing the reset button. How often can you push the reset button and there not be a consequence? We still are dealing with the real world, even if debt can maybe erase that for a while.
Well, so I guess if I took the devil's advocate position on what I just said, I don't buy that we're in a new bull market. The question would be the same one that Lila asked last week, which is, if you take interest rates to zero, do you recalibrate risk across the board? Are you allowing for a richer valuation structure across the board? And so maybe Tesla is in fact ridiculously priced. But if you look at the others in that mix that I mentioned that are trading more in the 30s to 50s in terms of price earnings multiples, perhaps that's the new normal. Now, you know, normal is that you can hang a question after what is normal,
right,
and what we come to accept as normal. And again, this comes back to, on the one hand, but on the other. On the one hand, I think that this is not a new bull market. On the other hand, if we're recalibrating things around zero or negative rates, maybe it has farther to go. But on the other hand, still, that does presume control by the central banks, and I believe they have control until they lose control.
And this is why critical thinking is so important. You know, Lila said last week, this is the most difficult time to navigate of any time in our lifetimes. And, you know, I think, look at COVID, okay? If you want to find something that completely discounts COVID, just get online. There's plenty of evidence that you can discount it. And then on the other side, you can see that there's a real threat. And so I think at this point, as we're making critical decisions, this is not to tell people whether we're going to have a new bull market or another crash. It's just, how do you critically think? Now, on COVID, it's the same type of thing. You have to gather your evidence, because sometimes underneath the surface of the mainstream media, you can actually make some pretty good decisions.
Yeah. And the word of the week this week is comorbidity. Comorbidity. The CDC released statistics showing that in 94% of U.S. COVID cases, there was at least one other underlying disease. On average, it was 2.6 underlying diseases, right? And only 6% of the deaths from the coronavirus, COVID-19, here in the United States, were from COVID-19 alone. If you start looking at the numbers of 180,000, that's a big deal. What is attributable directly and solely to COVID-19, 10,800, if I did my math right.
And are there politics involved? I mean, how does COVID affect either a Trump re-election or a Biden election?
Bloomberg covered some commentary in their columns this week showing that an interesting correlation between Biden's chances of getting elected and COVID cases increasing. And then the flip side, of course, that is chances of being elected declining when COVID cases are falling. And, you know, kind of chart it out and see this correlation. And I'm not wanting to wade into the coronavirus debate on masks or shutdowns, but I did think that the CDC stat coupled with the Bloomberg correlation was worth noting. Mm. What are the other factors? Of course, obesity, high blood pressure, other causes of systemic inflammation all seem to increase the odds of mortality. I mean, I'm not taking this lightly at all, and I don't want to be dismissive, you know, shrinking from 180,000 to 10,800, because I can tell you in that 180,000, I've got 8 people in my family who've had COVID, and 2 friends here in Durango who've had COVID. And I can tell you, it was not pleasant. But there's no mortalities either. So, I mean, I think I don't want to downplay it, but I think about little things. I think about my diet. I think about whatever I eat that might promote inflammation. Maybe I should cut back on sugars. Maybe that's not a bad idea in general. My point is, back to Biden, it seems that there is a negative correlation between street violence and Biden's odds of winning November, a positive correlation tied to coronavirus. Can we escape the politics of this? I don't think so. But if violence continues, you're going to continue to see a voter base migrate. And if violence continues, I think the Democrats could actually lose the House too. Hmm. Then you're looking at a very fascinating 2020-2021 transition. Could be the first Christmas of terror, something akin to, you know, the Weathermen, the Weather Underground. If you go back to Dylan's, you know, the Weathermen don't need, you know, we know when the winds are blowing, whatever. The Weathermen from 69 to 70, these are the guys throwing Molotov cocktails in the East Village, you know, packing bombs. You know, could we see that in the lead up to an inauguration of Trump? I think it's possible. I think it's possible. And frankly, if COVID doesn't get considerably worse between now and then, it appears that Biden's odds are considerably worse of winning.
Well, Dave, going back to the theme that we started with, the erasure of consequences or the reset button, you know, we talk about how the consequences may be showing up in areas that we don't expect. The buying power of the dollar, or the buying power of any currency in any country, oftentimes is the one that is sacrificed. That's the sacrifice or the consequence. And people oftentimes, you know, John Maynard Keynes basically said that's the inflation that only one in a million understand. When you can suck the buying power out of a currency, you can actually fuel many bubbles and anesthetize a lot of pain.
Yeah, I mentioned that sort of three-step move, and I'm going backwards here from mood to the economy to the market, or played in the other direction. The market gives you a litmus test for how you think the economy is doing, which affects your mood. And, you know, what people often neglect. And from that standpoint, if you can manipulate the market, you can manipulate the mood. So the indexes are really a key thing. If you want to buoy sentiment or keep it at a high level, manipulate the crud out of the market and you've got mood captured. On the other hand, you see impacts within the currency realm, which are not as easy. They're not as easy a litmus as just the stock market.
And the dollar's been falling.
Well, but you can look at other countries too. Shinzo Abe, father of Abenomics, he's leaving office early due to recurrent health issues. And this question is there. Do public policies and monetary intervention impact the value of a currency? The answer is, of course, the yen is already rallying just on his announcement of leaving office prematurely. And he stepped down because of these same health reasons back in 2007. Same health concerns. The yen rallied 12% against the dollar. Yes, policies matter. So I guess when we look at the erasure of consequences and the muting of signals, you just have to broaden your spectrum and look at other things that give you signs and indicators. And money printing, monetization, do they matter? Yes. And I think it's your currency which will tell you when you're stepping over the line. The U.S. dollar's dropped from 102 in March to 92 and change here in early September. If it doesn't bounce soon, we are going to have some real issues, and the dollar is telling more of the story at this point.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.